There are some interesting ties between our speaker this morning and the founding and growth of the Miller Center. One is that Professor Frederick Mosier was in the same bailiwick, in a sense. She spent 25 years in public and private sector executive level management experience, and Mosier was the doyen of public administration people by the time the Miller Center was being founded. She serves as counselor of the Department of State, special advisor to the President and Secretary of State on North Korea, and Assistant Secretary of State for Legislative Affairs. And in that responsibility, she had a major role in securing the department's more than $23 billion annual budget appropriation. As chief troubleshooter to two secretaries of state, her portfolio included Asia, the Middle East, Central America, North Korea, Russia, and Cuba, as well as transnational issues. She directed the Fannie Mae Foundation as president and CEO, and also served as a member of the Fannie Mae Operating Committee. So we're delighted that there is an opportunity this morning, and her topic of not only Iran and North Korea, but the rest of the world is in keeping with her travel. We had an introduction to that this summer when we chased her from Australia to Thailand to Korea, North Korea, and in the meantime, she returned to Aspen and back to these places as she traveled. So she's widely traveled, wise, as many of you remember, for her commentary on NBC during the Iraq War, and helpful to the Miller Center and to our students. So it's a great pleasure.
Thank you. It is, thank you. It is really a delight to be here, and I want to thank Kenneth Thompson for his pursuit of my coming and being part of the Miller Center, which really has an extraordinary history and one of the first universities to understand the importance of having a forum, of not only having someone like me sit here and talk for a few minutes, but really to have a dialogue and a conversation about the events of the day. And so I'm very grateful to be here. And I was learning as I walked in here that this is really modeled after the House of Burgess. And it really then, in many ways, we are sitting at the beginning of our democracy by sitting in this room today. And that's a great deal of what I want to talk about today, which is quite relevant given President Bush's speech yesterday about bringing democracy to the world. And so I want to talk about that a little bit this morning and sort of where in the world are we? We have been through such an extraordinary time. All of you in this room who are of different ages have lived through all kinds of different experiences for this great American experiment of democracy. But I think we all would agree that the last couple of years have been particularly extraordinary because the United States was attacked on its own territory, not protected by its two oceans, in a way we really hadn't before in our history. When Pearl Harbor occurred, which some of you in this room experienced yourselves, it was really far away from most Americans' experience. It was in Hawaii, a place that didn't feel like it was part of America, but 9/11 hit us in a way that, quite frankly, the rest of the world doesn't quite understand what it's done to the American psyche. So I want to talk today about where in the world are we, what I think the president's trying to do, where I think that's successful, and maybe throw out a couple of ideas for our discussion about how we might move our goals and our objectives a little bit further down the road. I was very privileged to be counselor of the Department of State under Secretary Madeleine Albright, who's now my business partner in the Albright Group, and to also serve as assistant secretary with Warren Christopher, who I saw a picture of, who's been at the Miller Center Forum, who is really one of the wisest men I've ever, and a man of enormous integrity that I've had the privilege to work with. And I had a number of really searing experiences in my almost 8 years at the State Department. I remember so vividly when we got the funding after the breakup of the Soviet Union for Russia and the newly independent states. It was a moment of thinking that the Cold War was over and the world really had changed, and we had an opportunity to help people get the freedom that we all had fought for so long. And it was really very exciting and very thrilling. And it was followed by some disappointment on people's part that the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union, really didn't move forward quickly enough. There was a lot of corruption in Russia. People wonder what was happening to Ukraine. We saw an overthrow in Belarus and really a pretty repressive government. And slowly but surely, we see that changing and come to understand that the development of democracy and freedom takes a fairly long time. It didn't happen to us overnight, even though we had our wonderful Declaration of Independence. We didn't get to where we are overnight, and as we all know, we still have our problems. Sometimes we can't get our elections over exactly on election day. So we're not perfect. What we are is resilient, and we can use our democracy to make the changes that we need and the corrections that we need. I remember being at Wye River with the Palestinians and the Israelis, having been up for nearly 48 hours at the end, and almost having the agreement go down the tubes at the last minute over a very difficult, the Pollard spy case nearly scuttled the entire negotiation. But at the last minute, everyone came to an agreement. And I remember us all getting on helicopters to go back to the East Room of the White House so that the president, Yasser Arafat, Netanyahu, Prime Minister Netanyahu, and then King Hussein of Jordan could announce that an agreement had been reached. And I remember so vividly King Hussein, who was in the last really years of a terrible struggle with cancer, bald, no hair left from his chemotherapy, standing in front of everyone with an eloquence and an aura about him, about the hope and the promise for peace in the Middle East. And I know the feeling that we all have today, that that peace seems as far away as ever as violence has escalated. Change is a very difficult thing. And I remember going with Secretary Albright to a refugee camp in Peshawar on the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan when the Taliban was still in control of Afghanistan. And women had fled across the border to this refugee camp. And because of the fundamentalist Islamic religion that many of these women followed, because we were women, could meet with them. The men that were along with us could not really meet with them without their faces covered. And we had a very frank discussion about what they faced trying to live among the Taliban as women. They had not only faced rape, but they had faced not being able to follow through with their professions, not to teach, not to be doctors, not to go out by themselves, always to have to be accompanied by a male family member, and how they had fled. But what they wanted more than anything in the world was to return home and to have Afghanistan be a place of freedom. And we see now, years later, after the efforts of the president of our country, that Afghanistan has at least temporarily, and I hope permanently, driven out the Taliban. But that democracy is very, very young and very, very far from certain. So I give you that sort of cascade of examples, the last one being, and probably the one that's the most just an amazing experience, was having the privilege of going to North Korea to meet with Kim Jong-il, the dictator of North Korea, and trying to negotiate an end to their missile program, which was very important because as long as North Korea has long-range missiles, those missiles can carry nuclear weapons, which is the way one best delivers nuclear weapons. So if we thought if we could stop their missile program, we would further degrade their nuclear weapons program. And finding out that Kim Jong-il was not the complete lunatic that had been described in books, not that he isn't an oppressive, horrible, authoritarian dictator, he is, but he's a very smart man, and he's a very calculating man, and there's a rationality about him, even in this really Potemkin cult that is North Korea. And although we were not able to finish that because time ran out, and I'll tell that story in a little bit, time ran out on that, one could see that even in this very horrible place where people have no freedom and no food and no economy, that there really was a possibility to move the country forward in a way that ultimately might give those people freedom and dignity and a life. But it was hard. It was really, really hard. And so underlying everything that I'm going to say to you today is that bringing democracy, helping people to find freedom, is a very tough task. Very tough task. So first I want to tell you a little bit about sort of where is the world? What are people thinking around the world? We see the polls here in the United States all the time about what we're thinking, but where are the rest of the people? I've been lucky enough to be a consultant to a project called the Pew Global Attitudes Project. And we surveyed 44,000 people in 38 countries in 40-minute face-to-face interviews in October of last year. And then we interviewed 16,000 more people in 20 countries plus the Palestinian Authority in May after the Iraq War in 40-minute interviews. 80 different languages this poll was done in. 80 different languages and dialects. And the results really give us at least one moment in time of how the world is feeling. And there's a lot of good news. Democracy is really what people yearn for everywhere in the world, everywhere. And in most parts of the world, people believe that Western-style democracy can work here, that the kinds of things they see that is America is what they want, freedom of expression. More than anything, people want a fair judiciary. They want a right to associate. They want a right to really have a life where they can move their own family's prosperity forward. But at the same time, the dislike of the United States is growing, and in the Muslim world, it is very profound. And it is not Americans that people dislike, and it's not America that people dislike, and it's not democracy that people dislike. Right now, they're not very happy about our policies. They see us as unilateralist, as not taking their interests into account, of not listening to us, listening to their views, but really being the 800-pound hegemonic power that we are, but imposing on the rest of the world our vision and our view of what should happen. Now, 7 of 8 Muslim countries that were polled after the Iraq War now believe that the United States may attack them. So much of what people took out of the Iraq world in that part of the world, the Iraq War in that part of the world, was that the United States was on a tear and that we were going to bring democracy through military action. That's very worrisome because we don't want shock and awe to turn into fear and loathing. That's not useful for what we're trying to do. That's not useful for what the president was saying yesterday. And painfully, in much of the Islamic world, Osama bin Laden is still seen as someone who will better take people's interests into account than any Western leader will. And that's pretty frightening. Now, on the upside, people have accepted globalization. Everywhere in the world, people think that we are all tied and connected to each other, and that it's a good thing, that it's brought different kinds of food to people, that it's brought access to medicines to people. It has made their lives better, though in many parts of the world, they don't feel that they have personally benefited yet from all that globalization has brought. But the economic problems that people see, lack of jobs, a growing gap between the rich and the poor, they don't blame on globalization. They don't blame on trade. They are more likely to blame it on their own government not really moving to act to make the changes that are necessary. People like what comes from modernity. People like cell phones and the internet. They're sort of mixed on fast food. But they like cell phones and the internet. And one of my favorite statistics out of the poll are 92% of the people in Vietnam think that cell phones have made their lives better. But only 1 in 10 people in Vietnam owns a cell phone. So there's a lot of aspirational hope that is out there about what modernity can do to people's lives. At the same time, people are worried about the pace of change in the world. They're afraid they're going to lose their identity and who they are. They're afraid that how they want to go about life is being lost. And so everywhere in the world, including in Europe, where Europe is creating a European Union, where you'd think this would not be the case, people want to restrict foreigners from coming into their country, and they want to restrict foreign influence, which is sort of interesting since Europe is becoming a whole. Even so, people are anxious about losing their sovereignty and their sense of identity. And the one other point I think is interesting about the poll, though you can imagine with all these interviews, there's tons and tons of data, is that unlike the United States and Canada and Japan, virtually everywhere else in the world, people do not believe that they have control over their own fate. They believe that other people will decide their fate. Government will decide their fate. God will decide their fate. Only in the US, Canada, and Japan do we believe that we have control over our own lives. And as a result, Americans don't believe that the government has a fundamental responsibility for a safety net. But everywhere else in the world, people believe that government should work to make their lives better and has an ultimate responsibility to do so because they can't control life themselves. Now, I tell you all these things because I think it's important for us to understand where people are in the world, to understand why they're reacting to what we do in the way that they are. And what I want to talk about next is sort of what people are concerned about. They're worried about North Korea more than they're worried about Iran. They're worried about AIDS more than they're worried about nuclear weapons. Because for many people in the world, AIDS is going to end their life faster than our nuclear weapons. So let's talk about what the Bush administration, what the president is trying to do, and how it interacts with this. And I'm going to babble on for another sort of maybe 15 minutes, and then hopefully we can get a discussion going. As I started this out, 9/11 really did change our psyche. For the first time, our oceans did not protect us. And I believe the president was terrific after 9/11. He really did bring the country and the world together, not only to take on the Taliban in Afghanistan, but to get launched a war against terrorism in a way that really brought everyone together. But somewhere along the line, that togetherness, that solidarity has disappeared. And in the Pew data that came out the day before yesterday that looks at where we are in this country, we are now polarized politically more than we have ever been. So what's occurred? What are the policies and what can we do about them to try to bring some of that solidarity back again? First of all, the president has said that we have to keep the worst weapons from the worst leaders, and I completely agree with him. That has to be a fundamental premise of what we do with American foreign policy, because as bad as 9/11 was, if nuclear weapons end up in the hands of terrorists, 9/11 will be nothing compared to what that capability can do to us. So he is right to work to make sure that nuclear weapons don't fall into the hands of terrorists. The president has put out a policy that we ought to attack first, that one of the things we learned from 9/11 is we can't wait. We have to preempt bad things happening from us. Well, the world has always had that option. The United States has always had that option. What the president has done is to make that option explicit. And what that has done is although there is reality to it, it has ratcheted up the anxiety around the world that we see in that 7 of 8 Muslim countries believe we're going to attack them. And it also has ratcheted up people's belief that they have that option too. They can attack before they get attacked. So we have, unfortunately, out of some real needs, raised the level of anxiety and the level of risk all around the world. The president has said, we have to act with those who are willing to act with us, even if we don't have the international support that's traditional. Now, I understand that. Having been worked with a president and worked with a secretary of state, there are times when you have to act in America's national security interest, and you can't wait for everybody else to come along. There's reality to that, too. But by not waiting a little bit longer, I believe, to work with the UN to try to get support internationally before we went to war in Iraq, we now have found it harder to get that support to make Iraq work after the war. And so whenever we make these choices, there are costs to those choices. And I think in this instance, although coalitions of the willing are important, I think we have sacrificed something that is equally important in the process. We have said that military power is foremost. And in the Pew data that came out a couple of days ago, we can see the difference between Republicans and Democrats. Republicans believe overwhelmingly that military power is sufficient, and Democrats do not believe military power is sufficient for peace. And what I think we're seeing in post-war Iraq is, though military power is necessary, absolutely necessary, and having the strongest, most powerful military in the world is absolutely critical, it is not sufficient. Because if we don't have the plans, if we don't have the international support, we can't finish the mission that our military has done so capably and so well. We also have a situation where our government is saying that the central strategic threat is really what matters. And although, as I said, I agree with the president that we have to keep the worst weapons out of the hands of the worst leaders, terrorism is not like communism. Terrorism can't be attacked in the way communism was. We can't ask people to line up because it involves non-state actors as well as state actors. And terrorism to people means different things. It's unlike communism in its definition. It's not the same kind of ism. And so for someone who's living in Botswana, where 40% of the population is AIDS infected, the terrorism of AIDS is as profound as the terrorism we felt on 9/11. And so having this as our central strategic organizing concept limits our ability to understand the needs of the rest of the world, and so we end up getting data like I described at the beginning. We also, in not moving on international institutions in the way I think would have been preferable, we have created new centers of power that may come and get us in the long run. By that I mean Europe now no longer sees its central role as working as a partner with us, but Europe more often now thinks that it has to be a check on our power. And if we do not have Europe as a partner with whom we share values, then it makes it harder for us to get done in the world what we need to get done. And I don't need to tell this audience about the difficulties we have had through this process with our intelligence capability. And I think that all of us, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, know that we really have to put our intelligence capability and credibility back together again, because it makes it very hard in North Korea and Iran to move forward with our policy because people don't believe the intelligence that we're giving them after the intelligence failures in Iraq. So we now face huge challenges, not only in Iraq, which we can, I'm not going to go on at length about, and we can talk about, I know Joe Wilson was here last week, and we can talk more about Iraq in the questions and answers. But we have before us North Korea, Iran, the international economy, AIDS, other transnational issues that flow across borders that have to get dealt with. Let me talk about them very quickly. North Korea, the president was correct to try to work North Korea multilaterally. There's all kinds of ways to work multilaterally. You can have everybody in the same room, or you can consult very closely with people and have bilateral discussions, but there's no question that we want South Korea, Japan, China, and Russia engaged in this with us. When I was the North Korea policy coordinator and led the U.S. delegation, in the space of 12 months, I met with the South Koreans and the Japanese trilaterally 14 times. It is critical to stay close to our allies. And even after we bombed accidentally the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, the Chinese ambassador, Ambassador Li, who's now the foreign minister of China, was in my office the next week to talk about North Korea. China cares about North Korea. It does not want a nuclear peninsula. It does not want Japan to remilitarize. So even though we don't have the same exact reasons for caring about North Korea, we get to the same objective. But my anxiety about North Korea is that while we've been putting together this multilateral framework, it's been now nearly 3 years since we have had a serious negotiation with North Korea. And in that time, they have kicked out the NPT. They have begun, I don't think they have finished, reprocessing 8,000 spent fuel rods. And if they reprocess them all within a matter of months, they can have probably enough plutonium for 6 nuclear weapons. And if North Korea has 1 or 2 nuclear weapons, they're not likely to use them and they're not likely to sell them. They have them as a deterrence against the United States. A lesson, unfortunately, I think North Korea learned out of Iraq was the only way to deter the United States is to have nuclear weapons. That was Saddam Hussein's problem. Not a good lesson to learn. But if you have 5 or 6 nuclear weapons, you have your deterrence, but you can sell them, which North Korea will because they've sold everything else, because that's the only way they get hard currency, and you can use them. You certainly can have a nuclear test and scare the hell out of the world. So when the North Korean talks happen in December, and I think they will, there will be another round, I hope that Jim Kelly, who is a consummate professional and a terrific guy, has really good negotiating instructions and we can get down to business with North Korea because time is not on our side. On Iran, I think it is very good that Great Britain, France, and Germany went to Iran from pressure from the United States and basically said, you better sign up to this added protocol of the International Atomic Energy Agency, because if you don't, you're not only going to have to deal with the United States, but we have huge commercial interests in Iran, and they're going to be at risk. And Europe has huge commercial interests in Iran. They do not want to split with the United States on Iran. If we have a split with Europe on Iran, I think it will make our split on Iraq look like child's play. I think it will be irreparable. That's how differently we think about Iran. So I think it is a very good step that Iran has now said that it will sign on to the new protocol, allow challenge inspections, but I think we have a long way to go from here to there to make sure that Iran is not a nuclear power. Unfortunately, and there's lots of blame to go around about this, because we have needed Pakistan at the end of the Clinton administration as we were dealing with the terrorism threat and around the millennium celebration, and the Bush administration has needed Pakistan because of Afghanistan, we have all given Pakistan a pass on nuclear weapons. We've given them a pass. And Pakistan is one of the greatest purveyors of nuclear technology to everybody. To everybody. And so we really have to refocus if we want to deal with Iran and North Korea on others who have nuclear power. And one of the things I hope the administration will do is really begin a broad initiative with the Security Council on what we need to do to really rein in nuclear power around the world. Now, there have been some good initiatives from the Bush administration. I think putting pressure on Europe, on Iran, was very important. I think the Proliferation Interdiction Initiative is a good one to try to stop boats and planes and trains from transporting bad things. Though I have to tell you, you can take a ball of fissile material and put it in a suitcase and walk it across a border, so it's impossible to stop this alone through interdiction plans like that. But I think given the power of 9/11 to bring together the United States and bring together the world, we have missed some opportunities to get people to really look at the issue of nuclear weapons in a broad and powerful way, to look at how the IAEA operates, to look at the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which needs some updating, because now we have non-state actors to work with, and we have India, Pakistan, and probably Israel, who are non-members of NPT but are nuclear powers. I think we've missed an opportunity in the aftermath of 9/11 to push to reform the United Nations so that it can be the kind of institution that can be useful in these kinds of very tough issues that we're facing around the world. I think we've missed some opportunities to bring people together to fight for the democracy that the president spoke of yesterday. I share the president's desire for democracy and freedom in the world. But unfortunately, unlike World War II, after which the United States built international institutions, moved as quickly as they could to turn countries back to their own governments, the world perceives, and I believe, that we are risking being seen as a different kind of colonial power, of a country that really puts out a kind of imperialism of ideas, where we want people to move toward democracy in our own vision of it, in our own time frame of doing it, in the way that we have done it. And people come out of different places and different cultures, and they're going to do this in different ways. And because we are the 800-pound hegemon, and that's just a fact, there is no power that can compete with us militarily, politically, or economically, we have to be extra careful and humble in what we do for people to hear our ideas and to embrace them. And in fact, if we aren't careful, then the very reformers that we want to support will be seen as stooges of the United States, and it will make their efforts at reform even tougher. We have an enormously difficult set of issues. People ask me, do you miss being at the center of all of this? And there are days that I do, but believe me, I know how tough a job the president has, and Secretary Pell has, and Secretary Rumsfeld and Condi Rice have. It is very, very tough. And because it is very, very tough, I believe that we need everybody with us, not against us. And in the boldness of the president's vision, and I applaud him for trying to be bold because the 21st century demands boldness, but in the boldness of his vision, we have lost our humility. And that's a very dangerous thing in a democracy and in a world that's facing very difficult threats. At the end of the administration, we were trying to negotiate this agreement with Kim Jong-il. I had instructions that had been agreed to the Principals Committee to return to Pyongyang with a set of instructions that if Kim Jong-il had agreed to the things that I was bringing, then I would have a date I could take out of my pocket to say the President of the United States would come to North Korea on this date. I traveled around with two suitcases for about a month. I didn't often travel with Secretary Albright because I was doing so much other travel, but I wanted to go with her on her last trip as Secretary of State, which was to Africa in early December. And I took two suitcases, one with warm clothes for Africa and another with cold clothes to go to Pyongyang, waiting for the moment when our election would get decided. Imagine trying to explain to the North Koreans that the greatest democracy in the world couldn't quite get its election over, so I couldn't come to Pyongyang because we wanted to make sure that we had continuity of foreign policy, so I didn't want to go until our own constitutional issues were decided, we could talk to whoever was going to be the next president, and make sure there would be continuity. That was the responsible thing to do. Well, you all know the end of the story. Between Christmas and New Year's, we made a decision and made a recommendation to the president that it was too late, that it was not a responsible thing to do, to go at the last minute, when now we knew that George Bush was going to be president of the United States. But in that moment of trying to explain to North Korea, the least democratic country on the face of the earth, why the most democratic country on the face of the earth couldn't quite move forward in foreign policy, I understood how hard democracy is, how humble one must be, and how hard we all have to work. Thank you.
Could I identify?
Sure.
Who'd like to begin the discussion? Robert Holo?
You said something to the effect that about the start of the Iraq war, that if only we had waited a little bit longer, things might have turned out better. If I remember it right, about that time, the last offer that the French made at the UN was a 4 months delay, if I remember it right, which would have ended in July. Can you speculate what would have happened if we had agreed to that?
Well, you know, hindsight's always a great thing. Not being in government, one always is without pieces. As my partner often said, my business partner often says, she understood and I understood the how and the why, but not the when. And by that I mean Saddam Hussein was horrible. And he should go. He should have gone. We don't know if he's gone quite yet, but he should have been taken out in some way. And it was probably inevitable at some point that there was going to be military action. The when, in my mind, was the issue, because it was not clear to me that Iraq was an imminent threat. In fact, North Korea was a more imminent threat. And because I did not believe that Iraq was as imminent a threat, I did not think they had nuclear weapons. They might have had a nuclear program, but I did not think they had nuclear weapons. I thought the inspectors had actually probably degraded their chemical and biological, and that was not to say that they couldn't reconstitute the chemical and biological and might even have some left over, but it was not as aggressive a program as they once had. And as we now know, the inspectors actually did a better job than anybody knew. So I didn't know why we had to move so quickly. And what happened, which often happens, is we moved our troops into the theater to increase the pressure. And those of you who have military backgrounds know, as you deploy troops, you get to a place where you either have to keep moving forward or you have to move them out because of the rotations, because of the cost, because of how you're degrading other parts of in other theaters. You have a lot of considerations. And so it almost creates a momentum toward war once you start down that road, unless you make a very decisive decision to step back. And there was growing anxiety that if we pulled our troops back, having deployed them, and things didn't work out, we wouldn't get them back into theater fast enough. So you get into a very tough situation. And I did this great fun simulation for MSNBC where I played the Secretary of State. And we were having a National Security Council meeting on Iraq, and Jim Woolsey, whom I'm sure you all have seen on television, if not know, was playing the Secretary of Defense. And this was exactly the fight he and I had. This was before we went to war in Iraq. This is exactly the fight, sort of like, but you're telling me, Jim, because we have them out there, we have to keep going. So I think that we could have and should have worked longer with the United Nations. And if we had worked longer and we had not gotten to a definitive answer, I would have supported going to war. But I didn't understand why it was so imminent. Now, I don't know whether there's any reality to this story that Jim Reason in the New York Times wrote a couple of days ago. He's a very fine reporter, very tough reporter. I know, I've been on the other side of his stories. That in fact there was a last minute appeal through a Lebanese person to avoid the war. I don't know what truth there is into that, but I wish we would have worked at it a little bit longer.
Next question. Yes.
And I'll try to make my answer shorter.
And let's try even harder to make our questions short.
Nuclear deterrence has apparently been very successful with identifiable countries. Do we have to abandon deterrence now with the advent of terrorism and a no identified government?
That's an excellent question. Excellent question. I think nuclear deterrence works, but it may not be sufficient. And by that I mean, I think nuclear deterrence works with North Korea in the conventional sense. And our conventional deterrence works in North Korea. North Korea has a million-man army forward deployed along the DMZ, probably 20,000 rounds of artillery, could obliterate Seoul. Even though we would win the war, it would be catastrophic. It would not be like Bosnia or either of the Gulf Wars. It would be more like a world war. In terms of deaths, there'd probably be 100,000, if not a million, people who would die in the process. And I think our deterrence is still strong. The problem is the non-state actors, that North Korea might get so concerned about the survival of their regime that they would sell fissile material to a rogue group, and they are out there. It's not the simplest thing to do, and North Korea would know it would pay a huge price to do so. But we now have non-state actors who have enough power and enough money to make it a serious issue, and the normal kinds of deterrence and conventional deterrence that we all are used to probably are not enough anymore. And that's why I think we need this broader discussion about what we need, including a broad discussion internationally about the rules for preemption.
Brief.
Being humble is an extraordinarily difficult behavior. What exactly would you recommend the government of the United States do to say, we are humble?
Also a really good question. I agree it's hard. It's easier for me to say what I wish we would have done. I wish we would have stuck with the United Nations longer and listened to other voices. I wish that in this, even in the Proliferation Interdiction Initiative, which is a good initiative, we are doing it with a coalition of the willing. And I wish we would take it to the United Nations and use some of the institutions that we have. I think it's worth thinking about the recommendation that General Clark made yesterday, but others have made in different forms, which is, should we look at how we're operating in Iraq and internationalize it in a way that we have not? As fine a professional as I think Paul Bremer is, and he's a foreign service diplomat who I have great regard for, it might make more sense if that provisional authority did not have an American face and involved Iraqis in a more fundamental way than we are now. I'm not one of these people that want to rush to hand everything over to the Iraqis, because it could be a recipe for failure. Because if we hand everything over too quickly, people won't have the capabilities or the police force yet to maintain the peace that we need. So I agree we have to be thoughtful about how fast we do this. But we need we need to take away the American face on everything. Because the American face on everything not only undermines our humbleness, but it also makes us a target.
What about the Iraqi face? What about Chalabi and people like that? Do we have to be careful or not?
I think we have to be very careful. I think that Chalabi has had a career of being the person on the outside wanting to get back in, had a lot of financial support from a lot of people. He is a voice, but he's only one voice, and he was an exile voice who hasn't been in Iraq. Now he is, but hadn't been in Iraq for a very long time, so I think we have to be very careful and do what we can to support indigenous leadership.
Dr. Weary?
Is it possible we may have reached the point of no return with the United Nations because of the fact that we have held off so long in bringing them in, and now they've been attacked, the Red Cross is withdrawn? I mean, maybe the United Nations doesn't really want to help anymore, and maybe we're going to have a tough time getting them back on our side.
I am a perpetual optimist. I don't think I could have done what I did in the last several years without being optimistic, because there are days when you feel like nothing is ever going to go right, nothing's ever going to get done or undone. I don't think it's too late. I think that the UN is a very important institution. I agree with that often bromide. If it didn't exist, we'd have to create it. I truly believe that. And Kofi Annan in the Pew Global Attitudes Project is incredibly well thought of throughout the world. He really is seen as a statesman and as someone who is above national identity. And so I think what we need to do, though, is reinvigorate our efforts with the UN. I think there has to be a discussion about reform. It is an institution which has to better reflect the world today, not the world when it was created. And that's very tough to do, because it doesn't make sense on one hand for France and Great Britain and another European country, because of the way the rotation goes, to be on the Security Council when, in fact, you're going to have a European Union. But asking anybody to drop off so that Japan or an India or a developing world country better reflecting the world today can be part of the Security Council is a tough go. But I do think we need to make that go, because it's an institution we would have to create if it didn't exist.
Do you believe, as a question from the outside, we should impose regime change on North Korea by force if they achieve 5 to 6 nuclear weapons?
I asked an unnamed official, because it was off the record, from the administration just yesterday, what that person, I won't even tell you the gender, what that person thought would happen if North Korea tested a nuclear weapon. What would we do? And the sense I got was that the administration wants to avoid a crisis for as long as possible. And I understand that impulse, because, as I said, if we attack or provoke an attack by North Korea first, there will be 100,000 to a million people dead. We will win, but it will be gruesome. Seoul is 35 miles from the demilitarized zone. It would be gruesome. So I don't want to attack, but I do agree that the moment may come where we would have to face that reality if we knew North Korea, if we really knew North Korea had 5 or 6 bombs and was working to sell those bombs. That would be one hell of a serious situation.
Down Nectarline, briefly.
Yes, could you say a few more words about your view of where we're headed with the European Union? Is it inevitable that we've got a split with France and Germany and perhaps others on the continent about where we're going in the world?
Again, my optimism will shine forth. Hopefully realistic optimism. I think France particularly is playing a game it always plays. France is the country the rest of the world loves to hate, almost as much as they sometimes hate us. And we love to sort of tussle with France. And I think France is both pushing against us for power, but France is also positioning itself with Germany in the European Union as to who is going to control and run the European Union. Will it be Chirac or will it be Blair? So it's both an internal and an external game, but I think the internal game is as important for France and Germany as the external game. Part of the problem we have is that Europe and the United States are out of sync and they're in their development. The United States is the great power moving forward, Europe, while it has to deal with all of these challenges in the world, is internally focused, trying to create this union that every couple of years adds 20 countries, which is hard to absorb. The European Union, as you know, has just gotten larger, probably will get larger yet again a few years from now, has a constitutional convention trying to come up with a new way to proceed forward. And so they're not ready to take on the responsibility in the way we need them to or would like them to. So I don't think it's inevitable, but I think we're going to go through rocky years. And for any of you who travel through Europe right now and talk to leaders, they really do see their role in the world as being a balance on American power, and that is not a good thing.
Other questions? Yes.
While spreading democracy around the world is a very wonderful idea, considering that a democracy is a very difficult governance vehicle and requires a people to be intellectually and educated and thinking, and we in our own country have a difficult time making democracy work as a form of governance. Do you think that the rest of the world, in its state, is ready for democracy in the American style? And by that I mean, would a change in our policy vis-a-vis heads of states who are oppressive, would it be in our interest to not deal with them as we have over the past number of years, and deal directly with changing those people so that the populace of the countries that are oppressed have better leaders, and that we are not showing two faces to them, that we are bringing you the freedom of democracy, but we are in fact dealing directly and helping the tyrannical leaders of those countries?
I think what you've laid out is in some ways the dilemma. And let me put it another way. We are very worried about terrorism, and we're very worried about security. And ironically, in our efforts to get the rest of the world to care about security and terrorism, it's actually in some very bizarre way given some of those repressive governments more license to oppress people further. Because we want them to watch people, we want them to control their borders, we don't want bad people to leave their countries and come to ours. And so one of the things that we have to be very conscious of, and as I said earlier, we want Pakistan to help us with the fight against terrorism, but in doing so, we are stamping some approval on their non-democratic government, because Musharraf ousted the democracy, might not have been a great one, but ousted the democratic leader. And we haven't really slapped them in any way on their having their nuclear capability. So balancing our security needs with our call for democracy is one tough order. I think embedded in your question and your statement are some things that we need to do, though, which is increase our public diplomacy, not by selling America to the world, but by creating more exchanges, providing more assistance for education, making sure that there are forums and dialogues within countries that we can support through mediating institutions that are indigenous to those countries. I think the work of the National Endowment for the Democracy, where the president was yesterday, and actually Madeleine Albright chairs the National Democratic Institute, which is the democratic arm of the National Endowment for Democracy, I think does fabulous work. And there ought to be more work that they do. What they do is they help create civil society in countries around the world. and election mechanisms and help train political leadership. And that was a bipartisan effort. John McCain heads up the Republican side of it. And that's the kind of work we ought to be doing more of, to try to balance our security needs against people's own development of institutions that serve their vision of a democratic freedom.
What model would you follow? Lincoln, who said democracy was not alone for Americans, but for people everywhere. Very brief. Or Senator Beveridge of Indiana, who said that we ought to give the blessings of civilization as only we knew it to the people everywhere in the world, the needy people everywhere.
Well, I am for supporting people's democratic aspirations. So I'd probably be more on Lincoln's side in that debate. I think that to say that we are the keeper of all ideas that are good goes across the line from humility to arrogance. And it is not that our ideas aren't good. They are, and people think our values are good, and they like Americans, and they want what we have. But we have to support people to go down that road in ways that fit within their culture and their framework and their development. And one thing I haven't mentioned here at all today, which I should have, is the role that business plays in this. I think business plays a huge role, huge. Every time we went to a country, we met with the American Chamber of Commerce. And there is no doubt that although China has a long way to go on human rights, a long way to go, American business in China, setting standards for how one works with employees, setting standards for what companies ought to do, has helped. So everybody has a role in trying to transport, transmit, role model, but not impose the good things that everybody wants in the world.
Dr. Cooper.
You've outlined an awesome list of things we have to do and take care of and that have to happen.
And that's only the first half of the agenda.
It's a discouraging list, really. And do you think that we can accomplish them with the present exemplar of American power and personality in the White House?
I have tried really hard today to talk about foreign policy. And we all always said when we were in the State Department that all of our partisan instincts were surgically removed. Because when you represent the United States of America around the world, you have to represent the United States of America around the world, not the Democrats or the Republicans, but who we are as a country and what we need to do as a country. There's no question, obviously, since I was in a Democratic administration, that I am a Democrat. And I think it's probably clear from my remarks that I believe the current posture we have is not going to serve us well in the long run. That although there are many things that I agree with the president on, the way in which we've done some of what we have done and some of the policies that he's put in place are not ones that I think will serve us well in the long run. So, of course, I would prefer a change, but whether that change happens or not, I think it is critical for us to have a dialogue in this country to shift a bit, at least, of how we're going about doing this, or that long list of challenges is going to be harder for any president, Republican or Democrat, to accomplish.
Other questions? Yes, from the back.
On the nuclear issue, taking a contrary position, if the long-term goal is international stability and the only characteristic that the U.S. Government seems to respect is power, and getting nuclear power by India was an attempt by them to get our respect, many say, and likewise other countries. So what's wrong with North Korea having a few nuclear bombs if they could then deal more evenly with us, and that our long-term interest would be to have a dispersal of power rather than one or two superpowers.
Actually, what you have just outlined is a point of view by some in the administration, who I think, a small group, there isn't consensus within the administration about how to deal with this, but there is a small group that believes that we cannot stop countries from becoming nuclear powers, so should work on containing them as opposed to ending it. Here's the problem with that, in my view. So North Korea has nuclear power. Japan is not going to sit around. South Korea is not going to sit around. They're not only going to build nuclear weapons, which take huge financial resources, and so if they start building nuclear programs, it takes away from resources to get other things done in their economies and in the economy of the world. Their people will suffer in the process. We will suffer in the process because of the downturn economically that'll come from using resources from that in that way. But more importantly, we will create a constant escalation among countries to build nuclear weapons and to find other ways to increase their deterrent capability over the United States. And the long-term goal that we have committed ourselves to, which is to build down our nuclear weapons, will stop. And I don't think that serves world peace. We could all end up with somebody losing it one day and setting off nuclear weapons, or some crazy person getting in and pushing the wrong button, or what we now have to face in this century is that it is not just about state actors for whom international norms can create a system. It is about non-state actors who don't care.
November 19th, we have another very fine speaker, Kevin Phillips,
who
will be speaking about the McKinley presidency in a different way than most people have approached it. We thank all of you for coming. Most of all, we thank you for
thank you. It's been wonderful. Thank you all.